Okay, welcome to the Maternal Mental Health Series. My name is Dr. Claire Drom. Today I'm going to be presenting to you the basics of psychiatric medications in the perinatal period. I do not have any disclosures. Today we hope to identify psychiatric treatment considerations unique to the perinatal period, learn about a risk versus risk analysis paradigm that we're going to use to inform our medication and treatment selections. And we also want to talk about some unique psychotropic medication considerations in pregnancy. So we're going to talk about benzodiazepine class medications, mood stabilizers, and antipsychotics. I'm going to start out here with a little bit of a hodgepodge. So hopefully there's a degree of repetition in this series. I want to cover a few symptoms that we're going to talk about differently in patients who are pregnant or who are postpartum. One of those symptoms is sleep. So assessing sleep in a person who is pregnant and gestating a human or who has just undergone a major surgery or physical process that is childbirth and now has a helpless infant to take care of, that sleep is going to be different than in somebody who is not facing those conditions. So here are a couple of phrases that I like to use and I like to explore just to start the conversation around sleep. As you can see, they're mostly for postpartum parents, but can you sleep when the baby is sleeping? And if not, what prevents you from sleeping? Another really important question is understanding what support that parent has to be able to get some rest. Intrusive thoughts are another symptom that have a different flavor in pregnancy, but definitely in postpartum, we hear a lot more about intrusive thoughts. And we want to bring this up because it's very, very common among both parents, among mothers and fathers. There's a lot of hesitancy to talk about this because the thoughts are so distressing and raise a lot of concern. So it's our job to open the conversation and normalize the experience for patients. You might find that parents will be experiencing these thoughts and are very distressed and punish themselves psychologically, sometimes even physically, out of fear of what they're thinking. And this can have really significant impacts on parent-child attachment and parental mental health, obviously. Psychosis takes on a different flavor, and we're talking specifically about postpartum psychosis. So postpartum psychosis is a distinct entity. It shows up quickly after delivery. In most cases, symptoms are present within the first 3 days after delivery, although may not be very overt or very extreme. And in pretty much all cases, they're going to show up within the first 2 to 4 weeks after delivery. The implications for us to think about then is that this happens typically after a patient has left the hospital and before they come in for their first OB visit, unless they've had a C-section. The symptoms of the psychosis look a little bit different. There's a lot of mood swings, rapid fluctuation in symptoms. Patients often appear just dazed or confused, and they often look like they are delirious because they just seem so out of it and things are shifting so quickly. It's really a striking presentation. There's a high risk of recurrence, nearly 100%, if someone has had a prior episode of postpartum psychosis. So it's important to know that history. Here's a slide that I have in here for you to reference to hopefully come back to. Sometimes we think of intrusive thoughts and psychotic thoughts on a spectrum. They're not really on a spectrum. They're quite a bit different. So intrusive thoughts have a stronger association with anxiety disorders, mood disorders too, but more anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorder. And here's how we distinguish between intrusive thoughts and then delusions or psychotic thoughts. So here's some points that hopefully, again, we'll reiterate throughout this series. You'll hear a lot about depression and postpartum depression, especially in the media, but it's important to understand that anxiety disorders are actually more prevalent than depressive disorders during pregnancy and in the postpartum period. We give everyone kind of a 2-week grace period after childbirth to be a hot mess. After that, though, if somebody's still having a lot of dysfunction, we might need to be screening more for mood and anxiety disorders. The baby blues that we'll hear about are distinct from postpartum depression. And when we're assessing symptoms, they need to be interpreted in the physiologic and social context of pregnancy and of having a newborn infant. That being said, suicidal ideation, extreme guilt, and frank anhedonia, or just not having an interest in things or an interest in the pregnancy, might be indicators of a mood disorder or that something else is going on. All right, shifting a little bit and talking about medications, we want to think about 4 essential time points in the reproductive period. So preconception, before there's a pregnancy, during the pregnancy, after the pregnancy, and right now, postpartum is defined as the first 12 months following delivery. And then if the mother chooses to lactate, that's another realm for consideration. So before someone is pregnant, any woman of reproductive age, the most important question you can ask her is this: are you currently pregnant or planning to become pregnant in the next year? Preconception counseling is, of course, going to include optimization of physical, social, and mental health, like we would do for any patient, especially with a focus of encouraging cessation of substance use. If somebody says they don't want to become pregnant in the next year, then we need to be talking about what they're doing to prevent pregnancy, with a special focus on long-term contraceptive options. If somebody has a history of mental illness, then we're going to talk about psychoeducation and how pregnancy might affect her symptoms over time. And she may also want to know, what is the chance that I transmit this illness to my child? So a little bit of genetic discussion might be in there as well. When we're thinking about medications, and this is for any medication, not just psychiatric medications, we want to ask ourselves, would this medicine be safe in the first trimester? Because we all know that somebody does not find out they are pregnant until they are into the first trimester, sometimes even well into the first trimester, when the damage may have already been done. This is a wordy slide that I have in here because patients will come to you having already done research. They'll already have been talking to their friends, looking things up, and forming their own opinions on the risks of medication. So we need to be prepared to meet them in that conversation and discuss their concerns. And for us to do that, we need to understand at a fundamental level where this data is coming from and how these odds ratios and relative risk numbers are being generated. One key concept that we'll talk about with patients is translating relative risk or an odds ratio to an absolute risk. And we choose an absolute risk because it actually represents what an individual's risk is going to be. We may also want to talk about what is statistical significance that will be reported in a paper versus what is clinical significance and the nuance between those. An important concept that a lot of people need explained is that background risk is never zero. So bad things can happen in a pregnancy that has gone perfectly and has had no exposures. So there's kind of this misequation between a bad outcome, like a malformation or a premature delivery, to something going wrong. But that's just not the case. That's just the nature of the complexity of pregnancy. So here's an example about absolute risk using SSRI data and major malformations. So we take the baseline risk here in the general U.S. population, and we match that up with what the papers are reporting. So a lot of the studies will use odds ratios. So a patient may read something and say, oh my gosh, there's a 2.5 times increased risk of having a baby with anencephaly if I take sertraline. That's really scary. But if you can present to them, well, actually, your risk is 1 in 5,000, and the risk in the general population is 1 in 10,000, that framework may mean something very different for the patient as they consider their options. Here's a little background on the quote unquote new medication labeling rule. So the FDA has moved away from the category symptom classification system. We used to have category A, B, C, D, and X in pregnancy, and that's been done away with. And it's moved to this pregnancy and lactation labeling rule. Its goal is to give a more comprehensive risk versus risk assessment of what we know currently with the data. It talks about risks to women, also to men, and risks in lactation as well. So that should be rolling out into older medications approved before 2020, hopefully. Hopefully that's going on. All right, so if you're deciding to use a medication, some key points are that number one, planning begins preconception. Another thing that we really encourage is counseling patients on the front end to not abruptly stop their medication if they become pregnant. Call the clinic and we'll talk it through. Don't suddenly stop a medication. And importantly, that there's always going to be a background level of negative outcomes, kind of regardless of the psychiatric diagnosis, regardless of the treatment. And that holds true for other medical treatments. During pregnancy, we think a lot about the biological factors happening in the mother and happening in the developing fetus that affect medication metabolism and excretion. In breastfeeding, we think similarly. Exposure in the infant depends on the maternal plasma concentration, the fraction that's excreted into the breast milk, and also what the infant's own body does with the drug, and that will change over time as the infant matures. The properties of the medications themselves are also quite important and inform some of our decision making. So, medications that have a low molecular weight are not protein bound and are lipophilic, transfer at a high rate into the breast milk. Bioavailability and the half-life of the medication also determine how much of the medication is in the breast milk at any given time. In general, the AAP says that an RID or a relative infant dose of less than 10% is generally considered safe for any medication. Oops. Okay, lost my spot. Here's another slide. I wanted to talk about medications for sleep and medications that can be sedating in pregnancy and in postpartum. So this is another thing that we may not think about in our regular practice with non-pregnant patients or patients who don't have young children. But it's important to really ask for the parent's comfort level with being sedated. They may not want to be sedated. They may want to be able to wake up quickly and respond quickly. And arguably, they need to be able to do that if they're caregiving for a newborn. Your patients with anxiety disorders are probably going to be anxious about being sedated, hence the need to be a little bit sedated, but that's another matter. We also, if there's postpartum and they have an infant, we need to ask about bed sharing. So, not room sharing, but bed sharing, where the baby's actually on the mattress with the parent and they're sleeping together. In that case, I really do not, and I want to say I will not prescribe medications that are really sedating, because of the risk of the infant being smothered. Another point that I want to highlight from this slide is about melatonin. So, we use melatonin a lot. We recommend it without a second thought. That is not the case in pregnancy. So, it's actually recommended to avoid melatonin in pregnancy. The reason being that melatonin products are not regulated, so we don't know what's in them. And animal studies have actually shown pretty bad outcomes in animal babies exposed to melatonin during pregnancy. So we try to stay away from them. Medications with anticholinergic profiles have pretty good safety data in pregnancy. The main caveat with these is that after delivery, they can reduce breast milk supply. So they may not be the best in someone who's struggling with lactation. Benzodiazepines. So they remain controversial in pregnancy and give all clinicians a lot of anxiety, and probably rightly so. The data with benzodiazepines, they've had difficulty controlling for maternal factors that lead someone to take a controlled substance throughout pregnancy. Regarding malformations, so we used to feel pretty strongly that benzodiazepines had a well-established association with cleft lip, cleft palate. However, as we're looking through the data more and more, that association is getting more equivocal. And at this point, we actually don't think there's a clinically significant increase in that type of malformation. Where we do see pretty consistent clinical implications are at the time of delivery. So there can be floppy baby or hypotonia in the infant, and then also benzodiazepine withdrawal, which can be life-threatening. As far as breastfeeding with benzodiazepines, the data set is quite poor. In general, we don't see a whole lot of central nervous system depression or sedation, so that's reassuring. We do try to select a benzodiazepine with a short half-life, so lorazepam is typically what I'll recommend. And we always want to shoot for the lowest effective dose. Again, we don't want to be exposing baby to a medication if it's not helping mom. That's a waste of an exposure. As needed use, meaning less than 3 doses per week, is generally considered safe. And we don't get too worried about less than 3 doses per week. Antipsychotics. So what we know about antipsychotics is we have older typical or first generation antipsychotics, and we have newer atypical or second generation antipsychotics. Right now, our atypical agents are prescribed much more frequently than typicals because they have a more favorable side effect profile. However, until the last decade, the bulk of the data looked at typicals. And so, because of that, we have the most reassuring body of evidence for the old medications that we're not using as often. Among those, haloperidol or Haldol is generally considered the safest medication antipsychotic to use in pregnancy. It's still considered the safest antipsychotic to use in pregnancy because we have the most data on it. I threw on here some of the placental passage rates just to demonstrate how much this can vary from medication to medication. You'll see quetiapine as being a pretty low passage rate. That's because it's a really big, bulky molecule. It doesn't move across things very nicely. And if you have a consult with me, we may talk about Seroquel for sleep or anxiety or for some of these off-label uses because it tends to be pretty safe in pregnancy. Another consideration, we talked earlier about in the mom, different physiologic properties changing, including expression of liver enzymes that metabolize drugs. So an example is the CYP1A2 enzyme is actually downregulated in pregnancy. A number of them are upregulated, but this one goes down. And olanzapine and clozapine are primarily metabolized by 1A2. So what happens is those levels accumulate in the mom, and we may actually need dose reductions during pregnancy to avoid side effects. So it's good to know some of these properties. As far as outcomes in pregnancies exposed to antipsychotics, things look pretty good. So the malformation risk across all the major malformations, there's an odds ratio of about 2, which is comparable to the SSRIs, which we consider safe. And this is similar across the typicals and what we have from the atypical medications. As far as pregnancy outcomes, have all been surprised that we do not see an increased rate of gestational diabetes in pregnancies exposed to, especially the atypical antipsychotics. So atypical antipsychotics, their main side effect profile are metabolic issues, including diabetes and insulin resistance. So we would expect that to be an issue in pregnancy. We don't have that data yet. It might be that in 10, 12 years we do see that, but right now we do not see an increased association with gestational diabetes. As far as neonatal adaptation or withdrawal, we also don't see this in the data, which is reassuring. However, we cannot say that a baby will not have some kind of withdrawal syndrome. I think it's pretty likely that there could be some symptoms, just that we don't really distinguish those outside of typical newborn behavior. Neurodevelopmental outcomes, we don't have good data here. A big issue is that women taking antipsychotics in pregnancy often have pretty significant mental illness, thus the need to take a medication in pregnancy. And so we can't really control for how the severity of the mother's mental illness affects neurodevelopment. We do see with newer studies on atypical agents that in babies exposed to these medications, there is a transient delay in development. However, they have caught up with their peers by 9 to 12 months of age. When it comes to breastfeeding, all antipsychotics cross into the breast milk. For the most part, the RID data is really encouraging. Those with the lowest RID are olanzapine and quetiapine. For the rest of them, we say they're quote unquote probably safe, question mark. The exception here is clozapine, which is contraindicated in breastfeeding. There have been case reports of agranulocytosis and excess sedation in babies given milk with clozapine and its metabolites. Lithium. So lithium, everybody's favorite test question is lithium exposure in pregnancy is associated with the development of cardiac defects, classically Epstein's anomaly. This one is actually dose dependent, whereas most other effects are independent of the dose. Outside of the cardiac defects, lithium is pretty neutral in pregnancy and is not associated with other major malformations. We do not know if there are any adverse effects to the fetus during pregnancy, and we don't really see withdrawal syndromes yet. That's not been reported on. So similarly, neurodevelopmental data, there's just not really good data out in the literature on this. There are a few case reports, but nothing that really shows anything significant or consistent. Where lithium does get tricky is in the third trimester, as the volume of distribution changes in the mom, kidney function changes, fluid shifts across compartments. We often see lithium levels dropping rapidly in the third trimester, so we usually need to increase the dose quite a bit towards the end of pregnancy. And then immediately after delivery, the fluid shifts occur again and lithium levels can skyrocket. So we have to manage lithium really closely at the end of pregnancy and right around delivery. Lithium is also quite tricky in breastfeeding. So it transfers into the breast milk at a high rate and can actually reach a pretty high dose in the infant. So if a mom is really adamant about breastfeeding and taking lithium, it can be done. It is very, very rarely done because the risks to the infant are pretty high, the risks of developing lithium toxicity, which can have really significant adverse outcomes. So it can be done if there's really close collaboration with a pediatrician for regular lab monitoring in the baby. Otherwise, we discourage breastfeeding in someone taking lithium. Anti-epileptic drugs. So we use this class of medications for lots of different disorders, psychiatric, migraine prevention, weight loss, epilepsy, of course. A lot of the data comes from anti-epileptic drug use in epilepsy populations. So there are some really good database studies from Europe. In general, lamotrigine tends to do pretty well. Depakote does pretty bad. In fact, Depakote is the devil. So, similar to lithium, this is a common test question, and there's a strong association with anti-epileptic drugs and neural tube defects, Depakote especially. Where I get really nervous is this other point I have here in red, is there is an average IQ loss of 10 points in children exposed in utero. That is pretty darn significant. In the world of reproductive psychiatry, the position is that any woman of reproductive age who's also taking Depakote should be on a long-acting contraception plan. If she's not, you probably should not be prescribing Depakote, and you need to be documenting very meticulously around this issue. In breastfeeding, anti-epileptic drugs tend to do okay. Depakote actually has a low transfer rate into breast milk. Lamotrigine is interesting. It has very variable transmissions, even within the same mom and the same infant pair. And so the levels in the breast milk are really unpredictable and can get quite high. So we were initially kind of nervous about using lamotrigine in lactation because of this concern for a risk of Stevens-Johnson syndrome, which is potentially fatal. However, we have not seen any cases of SJS, and we really don't see adverse effects being reported. I have a couple slides in here about zuranolone. This is a new medication that was approved at the start of this year. You may see advertisements for it, or patients may be talking about it. So it is a mimic of this allopregnanolone molecule, which is a neuroactive steroid. It modulates the GABA-A receptor and works kind of like a benzodiazepine. It has been approved for treatment of postpartum depression, so for depressive symptoms that started after delivery, specifically within the first 4 weeks of delivery. It's not approved for symptoms that started during pregnancy, and not approved for depressive symptoms that started 2, 3 months after delivery. It has not been studied in lactation, so there's concern about using it in moms who are breastfeeding. But it's a 2-week course of treatment that is taken in conjunction with a classic antidepressant medication. Seems to be very effective for this specific type of depression, and there's a lot of kind of positive buzz around this one. So we'll see what comes from it. It is replacing brexanolone, which you may have heard about, came out a few years ago. It's an infusion that is administered over 3 days, but nobody can get it because it's expensive and quite logistically challenging. So zuranolone is probably going to replace this brexanolone, and we expect to hear more about zuranolone over the next few years. I imagine it will be approved for more and more indications. In summary, we're going to keep reiterating this over the series, but planning begins preconception. So before starting a medication, consider its safety in the first trimester and really discuss that with the patient and try to suss out what her values are and what's her threshold for risk. If a medication is working, don't change it unless there are major safety concerns. Always shoot for the lowest dose that is effective. There's no point in exposing a pregnancy to a medication that is not working. Avoid exposures to multiple medications. Pregnancy is not the time to experiment. So if someone is on a medicine, optimize that first before abandoning it. We don't shy away from quote-unquote high-dose therapy. These side effects are not dose-dependent. So there's no reason to get nervous about the dose for the most part. In fact, many people may need dose increases later in pregnancy, so that's something to be on the lookout for. And when you're choosing a medication, talk about someone's desire to breastfeed and use that as a factor in considering which medication you want to choose. Here's a framework for how to approach these discussions with a patient and kind of the different elements you want to cover, including limits to confidentiality and under what circumstances CPS would need to get involved. Often, this is very reassuring to patients because they then understand that you're not going to report them for just having intrusive thoughts or for thinking scary things. You're only going to report them for danger. These are some things you'll want to include in your documentation when you're talking about medication use in pregnancy. So we include the risks of medication, but also the risks of not treating and not using medication. These are some of my most commonly referred to resources. I use them all the time. Mother to Baby is one of my favorites. They have a section of fact sheets on different psychiatric medications that you can print out. They're 1 to 2 pages long. They're pretty easy to read, and they're really helpful to patients. Okay, and here is your CME information. Thank you very much for attending and learning from our series.